of what we covered last week. Remember, the week before last, we had the promise of that a child will be born, Emmanuel, God with us. And that followed on in chapter 8 with the birth of the son to Isaiah. The first one, Emmanuel, God with us, was something way into the future. It was a promise of good things to come when he would come onto earth. But the birth of Isaiah's son was something completely different. It was a message of doom upon them, what was going to happen. And it was going to be very soon. Remember, it would be when the child could understand, in other words, within about 9 to 12 months, that these things would happen. And then it goes on, he says, because of all they've done, God was going to send the Assyrians upon them. And he says, you rejected God's way, that lovely, beautiful, smooth-flowing river, which would irrigate and be beautiful for you so you could grow nice. But because you've rejected that, you're going to get the flood of these foreign invaders, Assyria. And they'll sweep right through the land. They will go right through Israel and then on into Judah. And then God speaks very personally to mainly Isaiah himself. He's saying, you know, tell him to be strong and not to fear any conspiracy. Everything that these people call conspiracy, don't get misled by them at all. The Almighty God is the one you're to regard as holy. Don't listen to other people. Just listen to what God has said. And what a message that is for us today, isn't it? When people so often, they listen to what other people say rather than find out what God really says. And we've got all in his word here. We can check everything. And then he said, bind up the testimony, meaning that the word of God, don't let it be corrupted any way. Make certain that it's not spoilt in any way whatsoever. And he says, and then he says, look, my children, I and my children are a witness to the world. What God is doing, we're witness. And it's the same with us as Christians. We're all witnesses. We should be to the entire world. And don't listen to other people when they try and lead you astray to spiritualism and all kinds of enticing things. Have nothing whatsoever to do with it. It's totally forbidden. And then went on into that lovely chapter 9. It starts off with the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. Behind us, they've got all this darkness and things that have happened. Terrible, the state of things. But then look forward, he says. There's a great light shining. As they look forward, who do they see? They see the Messiah. And we have those words which rang down through the ages. Verse 6. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. And the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. This was the promise set before. God was going to come in the form of Jesus Christ, our Redeemer, onto this earth. And his government, he would set everything right. And then he goes on to give the Lord's anger against Israel, the northern kingdom. He said, look, for a while you built yourself up, you think you're going to be all right. You built all, but they're all going to tumble down. All your plans and everything are going to tumble down. He's going to take away from you all the heads of the people, all the leaders. You're going to have a terrible time. And he said, the wickedness there, I'm going to burn it up. I'm going to burn it up like a fire. This is how God always deals with evil and weak, by fire. Fire cleanses. Then we went on to chapter 10 then. And he gives the reason why God is so angry with them, what they've done. They've made their own laws. They rejected God's laws, which are so perfect, and they made their own laws, which were very unjust. And this always happens. When mankind rejects God's laws and makes their own laws, then you've got trouble, because they do it to suit themselves. Yeah. God's laws were perfect. Look after the widows. Look after... We had to be... everybody. It includes everybody. They were just and perfect. But man's laws are never like that.
we're very fortunate in the Western world that many of our laws are based on God's laws, on the Ten Commandments. Otherwise, it wouldn't be very nice. And then it talks about how he's going to send. He's going to send Assyria. He's the one who's going to chastise you. And he's going to send them against, now look at this, a godless nation. This is what he considered Israel to become, a godless, they've forsaken God. I dispatch him against a people who anger me. And this is what he intends to do. But then it switched then to show what Assyria was thinking. Assyria, in their arrogance, were thinking they were going in their own strength. It was them that were doing this. They didn't recognize God at all. And although God had chosen them to be a weapon to chastise Israel and Judah as well, they didn't take it that way at all. They thought it was we ourselves. And they went far beyond what God had wanted them to do. They wanted to dominate all the people all the way down. And they were coming down all the way down, first through Syria, and then down through Israel, and right the way down to the borders of Egypt. But that was not God's plan at all. And because of that, God said he was going to plunder them. He was going to chastise them. He says to them, does the axe, when you're chopping, is he in control, the axe, or are you in control? In other words, is God in control, or is the instrument? They were just instruments, but they wouldn't recognize us at all. But he said, after all this, there will always be a remnant. After all this chastisement and all he's done, there will always be a remnant left of his people. And this is the way, all the way through. And then he says, O my people who live in Zion, do not be afraid of the Assyrians. As you see them coming down, as you're getting closer and closer to you, going over one thing after another, don't be afraid. Trust in me, because they will never take Zion. They will never take Jerusalem. They went all the way round. They went through the rest of Judea, but they never did. And remember, we read all about this in Hezekiah. And that's how it ends up where we were last week. Now we're on to chapter 11. Now, in chapter 7, they had the promise of the birth of a king, their Messiah, Emmanuel, God with us. This was all set against a background of great darkness and sin. This promise of God is seen as a great light for those living in the land of the shadow of death, which we just read in Isaiah. Now, looking onward and then into the distant future, beyond our present time, we're looking right up forward now, we're introduced to the time when his righteous rule will come on earth in the time of the millennium. So now this chapter is dealing with the millennium. Now, we're going right the way through. The first 10 verses of this chapter can be divided into four sections. First of all, he's talking about Jesus, his ancestry and endowments, how he's endowed, what he's got, verses 1 and 2. And then the second section, how he would rule, how he's going to rule upon this earth. And the third section, what the world will be like under his rule. And the final section, the effect of his rule on the nations of the world that are around them. So we're going to look at those first. All right, verses 1 to 2, first of all. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and power, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. Now, first of all, we've got the human side of Jesus, the family tree of the Messiah. Remember how he was descendant of Jesse, David. He was great David's greater son. Mm-hmm. Now, the tree would have been cut down to the stump, and this actually happened, figurative, you see. But the roots were still there, as God had always promised. They were never completely destroyed. Although we just got a stump left, of which was once a great nation, it was a great tree, anything like a great tree, but it's now just a stump there. Yeah. But there was still life in it. And the stump with its roots remained the secret of vitality of life, from which the branch, i.e. the Messiah, would spring to life. First, a shoot, a little baby, as foretold in Isaiah 7:14. Then, to become the mighty king who will be completely vanquished the powers of sin and death on Calvary's cross. He will be endowed with all power, wisdom and knowledge. This is what he would be like. And now verses 3 to 5. And he would delight in the fear of the Lord. He would not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide what he hears with his ears. But with righteousness he would judge the needy. With justice he would give decisions for the poor of the earth. He would strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he would slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. It will be like the great King David, but unlike David, with all his human failings That's and limitations, right. His reign will be absolutely perfect in every sense. He will be absolutely righteous, and his judgments will be absolutely perfect. Yeah, we're in the millennium now. He would not judge by external appearances. You see, we tend to do this, don't we? But God doesn't. He would judge, he would see right inside mankind. You won't be able to fool him. He would search the heart and the deep thoughts and intentions of mankind. He would completely annihilate all that is evil and wicked. He will put right all the wrongs. He will be completely faithful, true and just in all his dealings. Now you see what his reign is going to be like during the millennium. Absolutely perfect, absolutely just, and nobody will be able to fool him at all. You'll know exactly what's in your heart and everywhere. Now verses 6 to 9, well 9.5 actually. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together. And a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear. Their young will lie down together. And the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra. And the young child put his hand into the viper's nest. There will be neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain.
Wow.
See, now, the whole of creation now will return to the ideal state as it was before Adam sinned. Everything will be perfect. Animals of all types will no longer fight each other. They'll be tame. You'll be able to go and stroke a lion. They'll all become vegetarians. And somebody said, how can a lion become a vegetarian? Well, I turned around and said, what's the biggest animal on the earth at the moment? What is it?
Is the elephant?
The elephant, yes. Elephant. What does it eat?
Grass.
Yes, so vegetarian.
Yeah, that's why when they say dinosaurs were with humans, they weren't Tyrannosaurus or
no, they were vegetarian.
They were all vegetarians.
They were all vegetarians. Even after the fall, they were vegetarians, those. They never were man-eaters.
Right.
And it's the same, you say the elephant, well, what about rhinoceroses, hippopotamus? What about your cows and your giraffes and your horses? They're all vegetarians. So why can't these others? They will be. And they will all eat. They will not have to kill each other.
Is there death during this part of
the world? Not. Now, this is a big argument on this, exactly what we mean by death. Death of animals of different types, but we're not too sure the lower, nature. Those with no reason power at all.
Yes.
It's just quite a complex subject there.
But human
beings? Not death as we know it now. There certainly won't be death of human beings. There'll be no death. No death due to sin. But it does say that a child shall die at 100 years old. So there will be death there, but for what cause? Possibly because of they've disobeyed God or something like that.
So no one will be sinning.
Pardon?
No one will be sinning.
No.
They'll be born to
other
end again,
isn't it? There'll be no sin allowed, but I'm coming to that later on. Leave this later on.
Now,
all venom and poison will be removed from them, and they'll now have the perfect relationship with mankind.
Wow.
So the snake and other things, they will no longer be harmful. So you could be free, you could wander throughout Australia not wondering whether you're going to be eaten or stung by anything.
The whole world,
the entire world from pole to pole will be like that.
Will
everything will be perfect.
Will my children be here?
I'll come to that.
Good.
We'll deal with that later. Right, verses 9.5 to 12.
The earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples, and the nations will rally to him, and his place of rest will be glorious. All the world will now acknowledge the Lord as king and willingly obey all his laws and commands. There will be absolute peace and contentment under his glorious rule, which will be centered in Jerusalem. Everything is going to be centered in Jerusalem. Okay. Everyone will willingly, with great joy, acknowledge the Messiah, Jesus, as their Lord and King. There will be no dissension at all about this. Uh-huh. Everybody would acknowledge him. Verse 11 to 13. In that day, the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the remnant that is left of his people from Assyria, from Lower Egypt, from Upper Egypt, from Cush, from Elam, from Babylonia, from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea, meaning the upper, the distant parts. He will raise a banner for the nations and gather the exiles of Israel. He will assemble the scattered people of Judah from the four quarters of the earth. Ephraim's jealousy will vanish, and Judah's enemies will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, nor Judah hostile against Ephraim. Now, he will gather the remnant of his special people, the Jews, from all, and that means the whole of the 12 tribes. They will all be gathered. We don't know, and even today, some of them are so intermingled, we don't know where they are, some of them, from the four corners of the earth. This will be the final fulfillment of his promises concerning the given threat. That is given right throughout. This is the final one. But now he is at this moment gathering the Jews back into Israel. But this is not talking about that. He's very careful. You've got to be very careful on this. He's gathering, and it is something that's absolutely remarkable to me. See, I've lived through this. I knew what Palestine was like before, and they tried to get them back way back before the turn of the last century, but they couldn't do it. But then suddenly, now they've all come back. And 1948 is a date, never forget it. That's the date when Israel was once again a nation. Now, this is absolutely remarkable what's happening. He's drawing them all back, but he's not drawing them back like this. He's not talking about it here, because he's drawing them back for judgment. They're coming back, and during the time of the tribulation, the time of Jacob's trouble, that is when he's going to judge them upon the earth. It's going to be a terrible time. Well, I'm going to deal with that later on. But this is going beyond that. He's talking about the time when Jesus comes, and then he will draw them back, and they will acknowledge him. But I will deal with that in quite a lot of detail later on. Just want to make that quite clear to you. Now verses 14 to 16. They will swoop down on the slopes of Philistia to the west. Together they will plunder the people to the east. They will lay hands on Edom and Moab, and the Ammonites will be subject to them. The Lord will dry up the gulf of the Egyptian sea with a scorching wind. He will sweep his hand over the Euphrates River. He will break up into seven streams, so that men can cross over in sandals. There will be a highway for the remnant of his people that is left from Assyria, as there were for Israel when they came up from Egypt. Now this again emphasizes the dominant position and rule over the whole earth under the Messiah. As they look round at all the great powers around them, he said, look round at all these powers around you. He says, they're all going to be crushed, and they will all acknowledge God. The remains, those who acknowledge God in the long run, they will be, but the others will be taken away. They'll be wiped out. They'll all be subject to you, and there'll be free, unhindered travel throughout the whole of this perfect world. Nobody will be able to stop you. And that's the situation we're left in the millennium. It's a marvellous, you ought to go through that and ponder over it. That's what the millennium is going to be like. Through here.
And that Gulf of Egypt, what might that refer to?
Well, it just mainly means that you'll be able to free travel.
That's the Red Sea. Perhaps.
Yes, wherever you go, there'll be no hindrances, no stopping at all. You can travel everywhere, that's what it means. Right, now chapter 12. This song is the concluding part of the section
which began with the people walking in terrible darkness of sin and death, but now a great light that was seen in the future has dawned. See, this is the song of joy at the end of this. The Messiah, the one in whom all their hopes of salvation and future eternal life with God, is come now. We're freed from the chains of sin and death, and he's come and entered his own creation in such a miraculous and incredible way, and it made possible for the captives to be set free now. Well, might they sing with such joy. The well of living water was now available for all who would drink from it. So you can see, he's terminal. This is what you've got to look forward. This is what's going to happen with the nation of Israel in the future. Now we go on to the next chapter. Oh, we'll just go through that verse at once. I'll read through it. I will praise you, O Lord. Although you are angry with me, your anger has turned away, and you have comforted me. Surely God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. With joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation. In that day you will say, give thanks to the Lord, call on his name, make known among the nations what he's done, and proclaim that his name is exalted. Sing to the Lord, for he has done glorious things. Let this be known to all the world. Shout aloud and sing for joy, people of Zion, for great is the Holy One of Israel among you. Notice particularly the personal note in this song. I will praise you. I will trust and not be afraid. Yes. Now, it points out that salvation is a very personal thing between God and ourselves. When we're truly born again and have that personal relationship with God, though, we still need fellowship from other Christians. We can't live on our own. That's why it says at the end, with all the Lord's people. And that's going to be wonderful in heaven when there'll be no friction, no disagreement or anything between us. But we are made like that. God requires, has made us, so we must have fellowship with our fellow Christians, those who are like mind to us.
Yeah.
Never forget this. It's so easy to set ourselves on our own. But it's built inside us. You cannot live on your own. Right, now we come on to chapter 13 now. Now, first of all, the first 12 chapters of Isaiah are concerned with Judah and Israel. Chapters 1 to 5, the great indictment and prediction of judgment. Chapter 6, the prophet's call and commission. Chapter 7 to 12, the promise of the coming king, who will gather the remnant of his people from the ends of the earth when he establishes his perfect kingdom on earth, the millennium. That's where we finished up. Now, the next 11 chapters, that's from 13 to 23, deals with predictions against the foreign pagan nations. Again, we see how God is in complete control of all history and the temporary superpowers. We're going to see this is going to be pointed out very clearly to us. In the midst of all this, the professing people of God live out their history. This is the Jews and us, the Christians as well, in the middle of all this. They're condemned, we are condemned for our failures, and yet being central to God's purpose for the world. The Jews, never forget this, the Jews are the centre of God's purpose on this earth. Everything revolves round his special people. And that's what's happening out in Jerusalem and in Israel now. All the things that are happening there are centred round his people. So if you want to know what's going to happen in the future, if you want signs, look at Israel. They are the centre. Now you'll find that nobody else will accept this, but as Christians, this is what God has said. Right the way through, they're my special people. Right. And everything, all history is going to revolve around them.
Yes.
So and incidentally, make quite clear, the Christians have not replaced the Jews. They're still carrying on.
Yep.
Don't get that. That's a false teaching. That's very bad. That we're dealing now with the nations, what God's going to do with the nations. Now, although these chapters deal primarily with the nations of that time, it also applies to all the nations down through the history. We can have the same principle, you see. And this emphasizes in the first 16 verses of the next chapter, 13.
which begins with the last days, i.e. the lead up to the Lord's day, his return to earth. Isaiah shows in seven steps the termination of the time of the Gentiles, ending with the Battle of Armageddon, when the Lord returns. He's going to show stage by stage, right the way through. Verses 2 to 5. Well, verse 1, an oracle concerning Babylon that Isaiah, son of Amos, an oracle, he's predicting, he's a prophecy, you see. Right, verses 2 to 5. Raise a banner on a bare hilltop, shout to them, beckon to them, to enter the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my holy ones, I have summoned my warriors to carry out my wrath, those who rejoice in my triumph. Listen, a noise in the mountains like that of a great multitude. Listen, an uproar among the kingdoms, like nations massed together. The Lord Almighty is mustering an army for war. They come from faraway lands, from the ends of the heavens, the Lord and the weapons of his wrath, to destroy the whole country. Now, first of all, the people we're talking to are holy. They're not holy in themselves, but it's only because they're the instrument of God. They're called the holy people. They are exalted in their own arrogance and power, not realizing that God is using them. God is not on either side of these people in the battle. He's just mustering them all, the armies of the world together, and it will end in an orgy of self-destruction. They're coming together into, and it'll end up at the Battle of Armageddon. They're all being gathered. God is gathering them. This is what he's saying. Right, verses 6 to 9. Wait for the day of the Lord is near. It will come like destruction from the Almighty. Because of this, all hands will go limp. Every man's heart will melt. Terror will seize them. Pain and anguish will grip them. They will writhe like a woman in labour. They will look aghast at each other, their faces aflame. The picture here of what the world's going to be like is of absolute terror, a feeling of helplessness as the immense forces gather for this final battle. This is what's happening throughout the world, you see.
This is coming up.
This is coming up to Armageddon.
Armageddon.
Yes. Right. Verses 9 to 13 now. See, the day of the Lord is coming, a cruel day with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land desolate and destroy the sinners within it. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened. The moon will not give its light. I will punish the world for its evil, the wickedness for their sins. I will put an end to the arrogance of the haughty. I will humble the pride of the ruthless. I will make man scarcer than pure gold, more rare than the gold of Ophir. Therefore I make the heavens tremble, and the earth will shake from its place at the wrath of the Lord Almighty in the day of burning anger. This is God's judgment on the world for, in verse 11, its evil and wickedness sins. All of creation will be involved in this judgment, even the stability of the earth. And the natural order of the heavens are all going to be affected. Mm-hmm. It will be a time of great terror and destruction upon the earth. Yeah. Verses 14 to 16. Like a hunted antelope, like sheep without a shepherd, each will return to his own people. Each will flee to his native land. Whoever is captured will be thrust through. All who are caught will fall by the sword. Their infants will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be looted and their wives ravished. There will be no escape for anyone. Sin will now take center stage, and we will see the unrestrained savagery of what people who have turned their backs upon their God.
All this mayhem is caused by rebellious nations who happen to be used by God as his instruments.
Yes, they are. God is using them as instruments. He's bringing them together. He's controlling it all, you see. He's bringing them to the... And now he's going to leave them about themselves. They're going to do it themselves. They're going to do this.
Sounds like a world war to me.
It is. It's Armageddon. It's the final. It's the big... The final...
It's not just on the plain, though, of Megiddo, is
it? It'd be centred there, yes.
So they won't think God's making them fight.
Oh, no, no, they won't.
They'll just think they're deciding.
They think God is used. He's controlling all the nations. Having described the day of the Lord, i.e. the end times of the whole world, Isaiah now turns to the prediction of the fall of Babylon. He's using the end times as a backdrop to highlight how God will ultimately judge all the superpowers throughout history in their own time. Each one. He's just using as a backdrop to make an example, you see. This is how God's going to judge it. And pointing to the final judgment when they're all, when it's all going to lead up to this, you see. It's interesting to consider why God chose to mention Babylon first and not Assyria. Assyria at this time was the dominant superpower, whereas Babylon was not yet to come. Their time was yet coming. Assyria was the super, but Babylon was rising fast. But Babylon has always in Scripture been described as the mother of harlots, the source of evil. Remember, the Tower of Babel was in Babylon, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. This is why God chose to single it out for his judgments first. Now, I'm going to say a lot more about Babylon when I eventually deal with Ezekiel and Daniel, but I won't talk too much about the actual destruction of the city of Babylon now. Verses 17 to 18 now.
So, at this stage, the people from Judah haven't been exiled yet to Babylon.
No. When Isaiah is preaching, that is over 100 years before this happened.
Wow.
Before that happened. But now, you see, he's looking on way into the future, into very distant
future. So the exile hasn't taken place yet. Right.
Yes. Right, now we're on to chapter 14. Verses 19. We haven't quite finished that bit there. Verses 19 to 22. Babylon, the jewel of kingdoms, the glory of Babylonian pride, will be overthrown by God, like Sodom and Gomorrah. She will never be inhabited or lived in through all generation. No Arab would pitch his tent there. No shepherd will rest his flocks there. But desert creatures will lie there. Jackals will fill their houses, where the owls will dwell, and there the wild goats will leap about. Hyenas will howl in the strongholds, jackals in her luxurious palaces. Her time is at hand, and her days will not be prolonged. Now, what Isaiah is foretelling is looking way into the future, how God will use the Medes to eventually destroy Babylon. They will be absolutely merciless. They couldn't be bought with silver or gold. They were only interested in conquest. All the glory of power of Israel will be completely destroyed by God's agent. This was all literally fulfilled. We got, by the way, I don't think I mentioned this bit in verse 17. I will stir up against them the Medes, who do not care for silver and gold. Their bows will strike down the young man. They'll have no mercy. So he's looking way forward. This is coming forward 150 years after the time he was living at that time when he was talking. So you see the prophecy looking forward all those years. And this actually happened to Babylon. I was reading an account of somebody who travelled through Babylon, where Babylon used to be, at the turn of the 18th century. And it was just like that. It was the place, there were ruins there and there, and the animals lived in there. There were snakes. It was all marshland. It was a terrible place. And remember, when he was speaking, Babylon was a fabulous city, beautiful. It had huge walls all the way around it. I'll talk more about this later on. But then that's what was going to happen to it. He was saying this, and he's looking forward, you see, all these years. This is what true prophecy is really all about.
The Hanging Gardens were a wonder of the world.
Yes, one. But I'll say a lot about Babylon when I come into Daniel eventually. Right, now we come into chapter 14. There's a great deal in this chapter. I want to spend a lot of time on it. It's very important. And a lot of the stuff I'm going to cover now, you won't hear, I doubt we've ever heard before.
Oh, wow.
So it's quite interesting. First of all, verses 1 to 8. Isaiah in his prophecy looks forward. Let's read it first of all, verses 1 to 8. The Lord would have compassion on Jacob, Once again, he would choose Israel and would settle them in their own land. Sure. Aliens would join them and unite with the house of Jacob. Nations would take them and bring them to their own place. And the house of Israel would possess the nations as men servants and maid servants in the Lord's land. They will make captives of their captors and rule over their oppressors. On the day the Lord gives you relief from suffering and turmoil and cruel bondage, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. How the oppressor has come to an end. How his fury has ended. The Lord has broken the rod of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers, which in anger struck down peoples with unceasing blows, and in fury subdued nations with relentless aggression. All the lands are at rest and at peace. They break into singing. Even the pine trees and the cedars of Lebanon exult over you and say, now that you have been laid low, no woodsman comes to cut us down. Now, Isaiah in his prophecy looks forward right through to again to the millennium, mm-hmm. when Israel will be settled in peace and security in their own land. All the oppression they had suffered under Babylon, remember he's looking forward all these years, would be forgotten. Everywhere there'll be peace and rest and singing for joy. Because of their blessed position as God's treasured people, all nations will want to join with them. They were brought back, to their own land under Cyrus, but they were still under his rule. They were part of his nation, and they certainly didn't have peace then. So this is not talking about that time. Yes. This is talking about the time of the millennium. It goes right the way forward. When God has promised down through the ages, he said this is what's going to happen to them. This is how it's going to be. Now, verses 9 to 12. The grave below is all astir to meet you at your coming. It rouses the spirits of the departed to greet you. All those who are leaders in the world, it makes them rise up from their thrones. All who are kings over the nations, they will respond. They will say to you, you also have become weak as we are. You also have become like us. All your pomp has been brought down to the grave. Along with the noise of your hearts, maggots are spread out beneath you. He's now saying what's going to happen to the kingdom of Babylon, the king of Babylon, when he leaves this earth. Where he's going to go, this great king. Okay. He will go down to Sheol, the place of departed spirits, to awake the final judgment. He will be joining all the other evil leaders and kings in their misery. All the great pomp and majesty they had on earth were replaced by the stench of their corruption, covered in worms and maggots. See how he's putting this? Now, you see, joining all these other great kings, all their pomp they had on earth, and where are they now? Now, I find it difficult to understand why preachers don't say this nowadays. They don't tell what's the final end of these people. They'll tell all about the beauty and the lovely, you know, what would be a Christian, but they never give the other side. Now, I think it's a great failing. We must say what is at stake here. It's eternal life with Christ in heaven or eternal damnation in hell. There's the two there. It doesn't matter who you are, what great pomp you are, you're going to lose the lot. All your riches and everything are going. Yeah. And when you pass from this world, this is where you're going. Mm. Now, do you hear that preached like that in these days? It's a long time since I've heard it preached like that. Now, these next six verses are extremely interesting. And I'll give you the background here, first of all. See, what he's saying now, he's trying to compare the king of Babylon with somebody else. I'll give you an example of this. Midas, we sometimes say people have got the Midas touch. Everything they touch turns to gold. That's referring to a fable of a king who were given this gift, and everything he touched turned to gold. Now, we don't mean that people, when they're going to touch, is going to turn to gold. But they're going to be like this. Yeah. And to explain this, you give the background of these people. Now, this one who we're going to discuss in here is the same thing he's using, an insight which we don't get in other places of the scripture, except in Ezekiel, which we're going to come to as well. It's absolutely fascinating. And I've never heard any preacher ever speak on this before. But you follow it as you go. And see if you can find out who we're talking about. Well, see if you can pick it out. Yeah. And this is the reason in this, you see, saying this is the reason why you have fallen. Now, follow these carefully. How you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of dawn. You have been cast down to the earth, you who once laid low the nations. Now, who is it talking about?
Lucifer.
Yeah. It's a pity they have this translation here. The translation in the King James's version is they actually say Lucifer.
Yeah.
And so they missed the point. Let's explain a few things about him. Lucifer, which means a star of brilliant shining light, was the most beautiful and powerful created heavenly being of God. He was the absolute peak of everything. He's described, and we're going to turn to Ezekiel to this, he's described as the model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. He dwelt in the most perfect heavenly environment. He was anointed and ordained as a guardian and representative of the Lord himself. He dwelt in the holy presence of God. He was blameless in all his ways from the day he was created until the wickedness was found in him. So everything was absolutely perfect. Imagine, he was in the presence of God. Everything was perfect there around him. And this was the kind of where he was living.
But Dad, does that mean angels have pride as well?
Yes, they've got free will. The same as what we've got.
Angels have free wills as well.
Yes, and it's because of pride that he fell. Right. Now then we look at verse 12. Why did he fall? This is his first fall. We're going to go through the others. How you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the... You have been cast down to the earth. You once laid low the nations. Now this is the reason. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned on the Mount of Assembly, on the uttermost heights of the sacred mountain. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Notice the four I wills. I will ascend to heaven meant he wanted to take over God's position. He, a created being, wanted to take over the position of his creator. All the magnificence and beauty that God had created him had completely twisted his mind.
Yeah.
And now, unbelievably, well, was all these, I will. He was, in his unbelievable arrogance, he thought he could take over from God. He could ascend and take over. Now, doesn't that remind you of the world today? In their absolute arrogance. We're not created.
Yep.
Well, where do you come from?
That's right.
This is mankind today. So you look at Satan, look at ourselves, look at the world around us. We're in exactly the same position. He imagined himself taking over all the glory and power of God, sitting enthroned in control of everyone and everything. He actually managed to persuade a third of all the created angels to join in him in his revolt. At this stage, by the way, now this is interesting here, at this stage he was not thrown out of heaven.
Okay.
He still had access to God. How do we know this?
Had he talked to God?
Yeah, where?
When he was talking
about
Job.
Yes, yeah. You've got it. Let's just have a look at that. Job chapter 1 and verse 6. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going to and fro in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Jacob? Well, you know the rest of it there. Incidentally, noticing that, he'd been roaming around the earth.
Right.
When you roam around, he had control. He had control of all the minds of the peoples of the earth. Yeah. But although he was cast out, he was not cast out of heaven, he still had access there.
Yeah.
He lost his position of trust and guardianship.
Yeah.
He became, from then onwards, the implacable enemy of created mankind.
Yeah.
Doing everything he could with the aid of the fallen angels. Now, the fallen angels, we know, are demons now. Mm-hmm. We class them as demons.
Yeah.
To corrupt and destroy God's earthly creation. Doing everything he possibly could to destroy it. This is the position right up to today. This is what the position is today. We must never forget, though, thinking about what Satan is like. Let's get a clear view, because the world's got a most weird view. First of all, Satan's cleverest trick is to make people imagine he doesn't exist, and then a lot of Christians won't believe there is a Satan. But then his next thing is to say, well, if you do believe me, it makes him a funny creature, you know, all these funny characters and that.
Yes,
that's completely untrue. He is beautiful beyond all description.
So was Mel Gibson's film accurate then? At that
point?
Up to a point, yes. It was a weird creature.
What we must never forget, though, he is still very beautiful and powerful. Don't forget this. But he is not omnipresent. His powers are limited by God.
Yeah.
Never forget, he's not omnipresent.
No.
So it's not, you were talking about the devil tempting me. It's not the devil, it's his minions. What Satan is doing at this moment, he's before God, and he's accused, he's called the accuser. He's accusing us before God. He's like he did with Job there.
So
you see. Now, this thing, never underestimate him. Even though he's got limited powers, he's still very powerful. Remember, now look at this. I want you to look at this so you can remember this.
Never
in Jude.
That's
it was only one chapter. Jude verse 9. In the very same way, these dreamers pollute their own bodies, reject authority and slander celestial beings. But even the archangel Michael, when he was disputing with the devil about the body of Moses, did not dare to bring a slanderous accusation against him, but said, the Lord rebuke you. Now you see what's happened there. Now I've heard people saying, oh, they're shouting at the devil, go, you don't do that. Anything you do must be done in the name of the Lord. When we confront him, or rather his demons, we won't be confronting the devil himself. He's got far, we're too small for that. Never forget that his demons are very convincing liars and distortions of the truth. That's what the devil and his demons are like. But when we confront him, always do it in the power of Jesus. Don't try and drag it on yourself. You can't do it. Yes, in the blood of Jesus, in his power and his power alone. Now, he's a very convincing liar and distortion of the truth. Do you remember Eve? What he said to her, he didn't tell outright lie.
No.
He just said, "Did God say?" He distorts it, and he's doing this all the time. He's doing it. Christians fall for this left, right, and centre. He destroys, distorts the thing. You've got it in evolution and all these things. How it's distorted. He wouldn't give an outright lie there.
Not the whole truth.
Yes, he doesn't say that you're not created. But he says, and this is what's happening, evolution is correct in the sense that it's a stage in God used. He's distorted the truth. It's utter rubbish. But that 95% of Christians have fallen for this. There are very few Christians who haven't fallen for this distortion of the truth. But then, go on a bit further, he's an absolute liar. Now, where do we get this from? From Jesus' own words. John 8. It's very important you know these, so that you know where it all comes from. John 8 and verse 44. He's talking to these hypocrites and that, the Pharisaical hypocrites. You belong to your father the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth.
for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language. He's all the time he's lying, you see. But he is a liar and the father of lies. So never forget this. Right, now, we've got that picture there. Now, I want to go on a bit further. That when Satan rebelled against God, he lost his position there. Yeah. That was his first fall. Now, I want to quickly look through to give you the complete picture here. The second fall of Satan has not come yet. That will occur at the middle of the Great Tribulation, when he and all his fallen angels, that's at the 3.5-year period, were cast out of heaven onto the earth. Where do we get that? Revelation chapter 12.
So he got defeated on the cross.
Yes, the power of death and sin was defeated on the cross.
But he's still allowed in
heaven. He still appears before God.
Okay.
He can still... He accuses us before God. But now we come to the point when he's cast... This is the point where he's cast right out of heaven with all those rebellious angels.
Right.
Now, we've got it here in Revelation chapter 12, verses 7 to 12. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. Revelations 12, chapter 7. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. Now, the dragon, of course, is a symbol of Satan.
That's the one that
and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, "Now have come the salvation and the power of the kingdom of God and the authority of Christ. For the accuser of our brothers, who accuses them before our God day and night," see, he's accusing day and night for her, "has been hurled down. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony." This is the power that's been used.
"And, so when did
and they did not then? Love their lives so much as to shrink from death." They've overcome. Pardon?
When did this happen?
This happens at the middle of the tribulation. Remember how the two witnesses, they were killed and they went to heaven.
Yep.
And now, this is what's happening now. Also, Jesus himself refers to this.
So this is when the Antichrist is going to be revealed on earth.
Yes, that's right. The Antichrist has been already revealed now. Luke chapter 10. I'm only skimming through this to give you the background to see where this fits. Sometime I'll go through it in a lot more detail.
I'd love to hear this.
Verses 17 and 18. He was talking to the disciples when they come back. Do you remember? They've been out preaching and that. Luke chapter 10 and verses 17 to 18. The 72 returned with joy and said, "Lord, even the demons submit to us in your name." He replied, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." That has not come yet, you see, at this time when Jesus came. We're looking forward, and this is talking about that time that's yet to come.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want you to picture what's happening now. It's difficult to imagine the full horror of the happenings on earth during the second half of the tribulation, with Satan and his demons freely roaming throughout the earth with no restraining force for themselves whatsoever. They are completely free now to roam as they want to.
Yeah.
We've got Satan and all the demons on earth.
Yeah.
The vileness of mankind together, now note this, the vileness of mankind together with the demonic powers will create a situation beyond our capability of imagine. You just can't imagine. You think you're living in bad times at the moment, you see the evil, but that's nothing. As far as you compare it with that, this is heaven compared
but
with that.
God must allow that to happen.
He's allowing it to show what mankind is really like, their capabilities.
Yeah.
And it's the devil, his angels, and the whole of mankind that's left during the tribulation.
Yeah.
This is how they're acting. And it will be absolutely vile, all the things they're doing. There'll be no restraining force whatsoever on them. There are no Christians there. And yeah. The Holy Spirit won't be there either, restraining. Yes. We've got to at the moment, we've got the restraining force. Well, you imagine what the horrible things happen in the world today, even today. I was reading an account of something that happened in Sydney. There was a woman, she was pregnant, and the husband didn't want her to have the baby. So what he did, he battered her until the baby bled so much that it died. They took it to the courts, and they couldn't do anything about it. Because the laws of the land said that they, yes, there was. See, he got off scot free.
Yeah.
That's. Let's just give a little example. But we know that the things that are happening around the world are horrible.
Yeah.
Now, what are they going to be like then?
Mm.
Aren't you glad you won't be here?
Yeah.
Some Christians think they're going through the tribulation. Well, good for them. I won't be there. I'll be gone. I'll be with the Lord.
Me
praise
too.
The Lord. Now, at the end of this second 3.5 years, which God will shorten, he's going to shorten, it says, to prevent the complete extermination of mankind. Remember, it says, a man will be so rare, they'll almost exterminate each other. Jesus will return with his saints. Ah, let's have a look at this. This is you. You say where you're going to be. Right, come and have a look. Jude again. Jude, verse 14. Enoch, the seventh from Adam. And this is interesting there.
Yeah.
Remember, this is prophesying at least 7,000 years ago. Prophesied of this. See, the Lord is coming with thousands upon thousands of holy ones. Mm-hmm. Who are they? The Christians.
Mm-hmm.
See, to judge everyone, to convict all the ungodly of the ungodly acts they've done in the ungodly way.
Yeah.
And all the harsh words, ungodly sinners. And so on. And also we get this in Revelation chapter 1. Look, he is coming with the clouds, and every eye shall see him, even those who pierced him, and all the peoples of earth will mourn because of him. So shall it be. Amen. So we'll see, this is the final coming of the Lord. When this is the coming of the Lord with his saints and on this earth here, and the situation on the earth will be appalling.
So, you've got the 3 years of tribulation, where it's
3.5 years,
and
you've got 3.5 years to the center point,
and then
the 3.5 years. This is
talk. People repent though in that next,
there'll be many, and the Jews, the redeemed, those Jews who have turned to Christ, will be the new witnesses on the world,
and then they become perfect again,
yes. At that time, at the end of this, where we got to, Jesus returned with his saints, and Satan and his demons will be bound and thrown in the abyss for 1,000 years. And there's going to be the judgment then, the sheep and the goats. Incidentally, we hear a lot spoken about the sheep and the goats, but this is talking. This is the true representation of it. This is when the sheep and the goats are going to be.
Is that after the millennium?
This is before the millennium, when Christ returns with his saints, and they'll be judged. And all those, but you see, those who've turned to the Lord, the Jews and that, were, they says, and there will be great wailing. Those are the ones who will be turn their heart to, and they will be the ones who will go through into the millennium. But all the others, all the others will be taken out there, and they will be bound with Satan and all the demons. And they're going to be bound for 1,000 years. And during this, it would then now this is going to last everything condition. We've dealt with the millennium, we'll deal with it again later. It's come up quite a lot. This is a time of perfect reign, everything is perfect then. But then at the end of that perfect reign, a thousand years, the devil is going to be released with his demons, and we're going to see what happens then. Now imagine all the people on the earth. They've been living, some of them will be 1,000 years old, because they'll be lived to great ages. But still, from those people, from the children, not from the original ones, from the children of those, they will still rebel against God. They will still rebel, and they will join the devil in, and there'll be a vast army of them, not a few, and it says an innumerable, a huge army of them. Showing quite clearly, you can't blame because of the fall and everything like that. That's why we like this. They've had a thousand years and still they're like that. That shows what the heart of mankind is really like, you see. That, I think that's absolutely, you know, the way it's done there. Very, very clear. And then at the end of that, we get the final judgment. And we'll turn to that. We'll just have a quick look.
So they have a thousand years of peace, but there'll still be ones who will want to turn against God, even though...
Yes, and they will die.
Good. Yeah.
Yes.
So there can't be perfection during the...
No.
Man is still the same. Man is still... Even though they're like that, they're still like that. It just shows you what mankind is really like. You imagine a thousand years of it, of perfect rain.
Still
and quiet, and they're still after that rebel.
So there's perfect reign from the point of view of the Lord, but the way mankind responds is far from being
perfect. Yes, but they won't be allowed to get away with it if we dealt with immediately. And so that's why some will die through that. But they'll be waiting for their time, these others. Incidentally, there'll be a vast quantity of people. There'll be billions of people on the earth. The earth will be perfect. It will give all, because it's here in a thousand years. You imagine what it would be like.
Are there any of our generations there?
Probably.
No.
We don't know.
Not in the final. There will be some who've come through the tribulation if they've turned to Christ. But exactly what's going to happen to them, we're not told. No. But it's mainly the time of the Jews. This is the Jewish time. The emphasis now, the end of the Gentile came at the return of Christ. That's the time of the Gentiles. That ended then. But now it's the turn of the Jews, then back. This is what it's always pointing forward to this time. Right, now, I've got so much more I want to go. We'll quickly look at this, though.
Just I ain't got enough room.
Revelation 20, verses 1 and 3. And I saw an angel come down from heaven, and the keys of the abyss, and holding in his hand a great chain. He seized the dragon, the ancient serpent, who is the devil of Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. He threw him into the abyss and locked and sealed it over him to keep him from deceiving the nations any more until the 1,000 years were ended. Now note that you can't blame the devil anymore.
No, he's not there.
Because he's been locked.
He's not tormenting them or anything.
But after that, he must be set free for a short while. Mm. Right, now verses 7 to 10. When the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison. He will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle to number. They are like the sand on the seashore, a vast number of them, not just a few. They march across the breadth of the earth and surround the camp of God's people, the city he loves. But fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, where the beast and the false prophets have been thrown. They'll be tormented day and night forever and ever.
Yeah.
And then, after that, we've got the judgment of the rest of the world. They'll be raised for judgment then. Now, I want to go a bit further on this to give you a bit more information here. The three falls of Satan, you've got the three falls, and the first fall when he was lost his position in heaven because of his rebellion. The second fall was when they were cast out of heaven. That hasn't come yet.
Yeah.
That's yet to come. And the third fall is when he's cast in the final date. Now, these are described in Ezekiel. And it's interesting to see, you know, how this backs into Ezekiel as well. And it's in chapter 28. Ezekiel chapter 28, if I can find it. Right. And it starts at verse, end of verse 10, just halfway through. Now, this is a similar situation to when the one we're dealing with, he's comparing the king of Babylon with Satan. Well, here he's comparing the king of Tyre with Satan in exactly the same way, you see. So it's rather a mirror image, if you like, of it.
Was it 8:10 there?
Ezekiel 28, and it's about halfway through the verse. I have spoken, declares the Sovereign Lord. The word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, take up a lament concerning the king of Tyre, and say to him,
This is what the Sovereign Lord says. And now, you see, he's comparing him now with Satan. Mm. Now, this is Satan himself, because it couldn't possibly be the King of Tyre. You are a model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You are in Eden, the garden of God. In other words, a perfect situation that were in heaven. Every precious stone adorned you. Ruby, topaz and emerald. Chrysolite, onyx and jasper. Sapphire, turquoise and beryl. Your settings and mountains were made of gold. On the day you were created, they were prepared. You remember this? Mm-hmm. He was created. You were anointed as a guardian cherub. Now, the cherubs were the most powerful of the heavenly beings. Mm-hmm. Remember, it was a cherub that was set at the Garden of Eden to prevent...
Definitely.
It was the cherubs also on the mercy seat, wasn't it? For I ordained you. You were on... He was set there to really guard the Lord himself. Mm-hmm. You were on the holy mount of God. You walked among the fiery stones. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created. Foot to wickedness are found in you. Through your widespread trade, you were filled with violence and you sinned. So I drove you in disgrace from the mount of God. I expelled you, O guardian cherub, from among the fiery stones. Your heart became proud on account, what? On account of your beauty. And you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. So I threw you to the earth. I made a spectacle of you before kings. And by your many sins and dishonest trade, you have desecrated your sanctuaries. So I made fire come down for you, and it consumed you. I reduced you to ashes on the ground in the sight of all. And this is what his end was, you see.
What do you mean dishonest trade? What have you been trading up?
Well, remember, you've got a double thing here. You've got the King of Tyre and him as well. So you've got to be a little bit careful there. But he's all acting, all his... what he's doing through the world today here.
Right.
Now we come to the next five verses of... we'll finish this chapter off, shall we, on this here. We're talking now, we switch back now, King of Babylon. No, I haven't finished off the reading here, have I?
No.
In Isaiah. I'll go back over that. I'll go 14. Back 14. On 14. Verse 14. We're chapter 14 and verse 14. I'll explain a bit further on this. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. In other words, the clouds are always spoken of as power and glory. You remember the Lord on Mount Sinai, it was the clouds there. I will make myself like the Most High. Absolute madness. He wanted to make himself like God himself. But you brought down to the grave, to the depths of the pit. Those who see you stare at you. They ponder your fate. Is this the man who shook the earth and made kingdoms tremble? The man who made the world a desert, who overthrew its cities, who would not let its captives go home?
Yeah.
Those who are captive now to the devil. Your father, you see, you're held captive. The world as it stands is in chains.
Yes.
The chains are set. It's not until Christ comes and breaks those chains.
Yes.
Remember I told you about Rousseau? He said, the world, man was born free, but everywhere we see him in chains, we see him in bonds. It's the upside down, he got it wrong. We're born in sin. We're in chains.
Yes.
It's not until Christ. What did the hymn writer say? My chains fell off, my heart was free.
Yeah.
It's that point there. They're still in chains to Satan. Now then, now the next five verses we're dealing with. We've dealt with those. You stare. That's what he's like now. All the kings of verse 18 now. All the kings of the nations lie in state. Each in his own tomb. Now he's talking to you about the King of Babylon. You are cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch. You are covered with the slain, with those who pierce by the sword. Those you descend to the stones of the pit, like a corpse trampled underfoot. You will not join them in the burial, for you have destroyed your land and killed your people. The offspring of the wicked will never be mentioned again. Prepare a place to slaughter his sons for the sins of their forefathers. They are not to rise to inherit the land and cover the earth with their cities. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord Almighty. I will cut off from Babylon her name and survivors, her offspring and descendants, declares the Lord. I will turn her into a place for owls and into a swampland. I will sweep her with a broom of destruction, declares the Lord Almighty. Now these verses now switches back to the judgment, the fate of Babylon. And this was all literally fulfilled. This is what happened to that great city. Now, having dealt with a worldwide view of God's judgment of all the nations and peoples of the world, symbolized by Babylon, this is a symbol of the world. You see, Babylon is always a symbol of the world, the godless world. He now turns to the judgment of the individual nations and starts with Assyria, who was the immediate threat to Judah. Yes, so he's switching back now to this is the present time where they were at that time. He's come back before he was talking 150 years into the future. And when he was talking about the devil, of course, he went way on into the distant future. But now he's coming back to their present time. Verses 24 to 27. The Lord Almighty has sworn, surely as I have planned, so it will be. So I have purposed, so it will be stand. I will crush the Assyrians in my land, and on my mountains I will trample them down. His yoke will be taken from my people, and his burden removed from their shoulders. This is the plan determined for the whole world. This is the hand stretched out over all nations. For the Lord Almighty has purposed, and who can thwart him? His hand is stretched out, and who can turn it back? God now tells them that the mighty empire of Assyria, which seemed to be invincible and all-powerful, will be completely crushed. It was all planned by God, who was in complete control of all the nations. He would actually do this under the Babylonians, and they would witness it for themselves. This is the people of Judah, you see, are going to witness it, they're going to see it. And also the people of Israel will see it as well. In verse 26, he tells us that his dealings with Assyria is an example of how you would deal with the world superpowers throughout the ages. You see, he's talking to the all ages here. It will be a visible evidence to them of his power and absolute control of all the nations of the world. Assyria at that time was the superpower, absolutely dominant and seemingly and savagely irresistible. Nobody could stand against him. Yet they themselves were the people in Judah and Israel were actually going to witness their crushing and oblivion. Now this is a very stark and very real lesson to us. Yet still there are many Christians who won't believe that God is really in control of all the nations of the world. Now I've seen myself this happen. I was young before I remember when the Nazi Germany came into power. I was still quite young then, so I was able to witness the whole way through. And I saw them rise to great power, and I saw the Nazis as they came sweeping through Europe. Nothing could stop them. They crushed everywhere. There were Belgians, Holland, everywhere they went. They crushed them, then into France, right the way through. And the British had to flee for their lives at Dunkirk. They went, and they seemed absolutely invincible at that time. And there was tiny little Britain all by themselves. And Britain, what people don't realise, was virtually defenceless. I know, because I was part of the Dad's army. Do you know what we had to fight with, the first ones? I came later, but with the first ones, they had pitchforks against the machine guns of the Nazis. They would have been hopeless. But it was not God's purpose. He was in control there. Yeah. And that stopped at that point. And I saw the end of that nation, how they were completely crushed.
But no one would recognise that was
no,
doing.
This was God's hand on the nation. You've seen yourself what happened to Russia, the superpower, the great superpower.
And now what happened?
And now what's happened to it? And see, God is saying, all nations of the world are under my control. And you've got to understand this. You can see the whole world, all the nations. And as he was saying this to Assyria, you're going to see it. Now you've seen it, but do you believe it?
very few Christians to believe this.
Yeah.
What's happening in the Middle East now is God is control. It is God, Bush America. And America in America. They think they're the mighty power, and it's them.
But
it's not.
Then,
God is using them. And we're going to see what's going to happen when they've gone there. God is fulfilling his purposes there. And it's the same for in Israel, you see. God is in absolute control. They're not going to be crushed. They're not going to be pushed out to the sea.
No.
They're a tiny little nation. We remember the Six-Stage War. See what happened there.
Mm-hmm.
God is still in control. Get it into our minds that God is in control of everything, the whole nation. He's moving them like a chess player. But he's also, looking at that, he's in control of your life, in control of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Look back and see how God has controlled it.
Yep.
We've rebelled, we've been sinful at times,
definitely.
And we've been punished in a sense for it. We've brought it on ourselves.
Yeah.
But God is complete control. Whatever happens to us, wherever we go, and if we trust him, he will not let us down.
So
it's very hard to get hold of that.
The nation of Islam will fall one day then.
Well, we'll see. Yes, it will.
It
will join up. Yeah, I believe that the,
on the, last page,
the nation the last of Islam page. Is the false, it's really the false, is the name, well, it's not the false prophet, but it's being used by that.
Yeah.
It's got all, you've got the book of the Quran, which is the false Bible, if you like, and you've got the Muhammad, who is the false Christ.
Yes.
The in his way, but their picture, Muhammad was not the Antichrist or the false prophet,
no.
Though they had to come, but they're just pictures, and God will use them. And I think we should be pray for the people. They're under a great delusion. Why are they doing this? And I've said this before. Why don't the Christians attack them where they should do, not in what they're doing, but on their beliefs?
Yes.
I tell you
right.
The reason why they don't attack them on their beliefs, because they're not sure themselves. They're afraid that they themselves will get attacked on their beliefs. And that's the fault of the Christians today. If we really believe what we are, and we're really firm in that, we wouldn't be afraid. They'd just fall like ninepins. I mean, what do they believe in? A man, who had all kinds of delusions, and they're doing exactly what this one man said.
Mm.
Compare that with what your Christian belief
that's
is.
That's right.
They're under a great delusion, but pray for them.
But they
they
believe.
They're being deceived.
Yeah, they're being deceived, but they really believe that they did it for God.
They think, yes they're
they
under a great delusion. That's why you must pray
been.
For these people that they've got.
They're being
but
deceived.
I think the big fault now with the Christian church is that they are not making certain that the Christians themselves have a thorough foundation to their belief.
Mm.
It's all on the tops. I heard Wayne once said the belief of many Christians in Africa is just wafer thick on the top. It's the same with the people in Australia as well.
That's
it's just
right.
wafer thick. If they really believe what they and really preach what they said, then these others would they couldn't stand an earthly. Why are people turning to Islam and not Christianity? Why are they going that way?
Because they're very certain
in
their faith. They're very studying the word of the thing that the God.
Yeah, they've been so deceived. Remember, Satan is very, very clever.
Yeah,
and then
you've
got this looks good and everything there. And the Christians have got no answer where they should have. Right, well, can we just finish off this section now then?
Yeah.
So we've got a clear sweep next time. Now we go to verses 28 to 32. This oracle came in the year of King Ahaz died. Do not rejoice, all you Philistines, that the rod that struck you is broken.
Mm.
From the root of the snake will spring up a viper. Its fruit will be a darting, venomous serpent. The poorest of the poor will find pasture. The needy will lie down in safety. But your root I will destroy by famine. It will slay your survivors.
Mm.
Wail, O gate! Howl, O city! Melt away, all you Philistines! A cloud of smoke comes from the north, and there is not a straggler in its ranks. What answer shall be given to the envoys of that nation? The Lord has established Zion, and in her his afflicted people will find refuge. And now this probably, the background to this bit here, it probably happened at the time of the death of Ahaz.
the King Ahaziah, and now we have King Hezekiah on the throne. Now, what probably happened was the Philistines wanted to make an alliance with Hezekiah against the Assyrians as they were coming down there. And this is what Isaiah is saying to them. The Philistines, they're going to be destroyed completely. Look at them. Don't make anything with them. That's man. But you, Zion, if you trust in God, you will always find a refuge. And that's what Hezekiah did. He didn't make any alliance with the Philistines. And I think that's where we end up today.